Hey, Andrew.
Hey Tom, how's it going?
It's going really well. I'm not super motivated at the moment, but things are going well. Just not
Yeah.
very motivated to do much more than what I'm doing.
Yeah, I got really busy, so I have kind of been focused on the things I'm doing, but yeah, you're kind of the same thing. I'm not doing other stuff. I'm just focusing on those things.
Are you still really busy?
Yeah, deep in the heart of the working on this exhibition and documentary. And then I'm also working on a thing for that immersive pop-up that's coming up, not this weekend, but the next. So we've been working on that a lot.
So in early November.
Yeah. And then the Denver Film Fest is going to be that week too. So like that's going to be really busy. So I can't see, there's no light at the end of the tunnel where I'm not going to be busy.
Wow. I guess I'm at the end of that tunnel, whatever that means, but I'm having a hard time jumping starting myself. How do you jump start when you get the blahs? You ever get the doldrums, Andrew?
Yeah, the last couple of years, I'd say there's been lots of times when I just didn't feel motivated. Like I have some time to work on something, and it's just like I watched like an episode of Hawaii 5-0, like the original Hawaii 5-0. I've been watching that lately, and I think what happens is if I do something like that, or if I go to a concert or something where I'm just standing there like watching a band, I feel like, oh, I really should be home doing something. Like, so then that kind of motivates me maybe for like the next night to like get something done. It's kind of like a lost leader, you know. It's like you gotta feel like you're wasting time in order to pick up and get motivated.
So Hawaii 5-0, the only thing I can think of that I recall about Hawaii 5-0, I think it's a Quinn Martin production, isn't it? Or is it?
That I'm not sure. I haven't seen that on the
Usually
intros or
they do,
anything.
and it doesn't have the like flutes and the bongos like all of the other Quinn Martin. I love their
Yeah, I just
music.
yeah, the music is great, and like something. I mean, I don't know if I really ever watched much of that show. Like, I know the song really well, and I know a couple of the characters, like you know Dano and what's his name, Jack Lord's character. I'm drawing a blank now. McGarrett.
Garrett, Steve McGarrett.
Yeah, Stephen Garrett. But like it's really like vague, like if I've ever really watched it too much. But I was kind of missing Hawaii. Several friends of mine have been to Hawaii in the last several months, and like I've been there several times throughout life. So after a couple years of not going, I start missing it, and then I see all these people's pictures and stuff, and I want to go back. So sometimes I watch like a new TV show, like the new Hawaii 5-0 or something, because it's filmed on location. Just to get my fill of it, kind of. But I was searching on the new Hawaii 5-0, and I saw the old one. I was like, oh, I'll try that out. And it's cool because it's like 60s and 70s Honolulu, so it's just really cool looking, and like just that dated kind of colorization, how things looked in that era of television.
That's the only one I know. Jack
Yeah,
Lord.
there's a new one. But and you know, I've watched several episodes now, and they definitely are, you know, they're addressing the issues of Hawaii at the time, which was like real estate developers, like shady real estate developers, and like Hawaiian gangs and smuggling, and you know, it's kind of cool to watch, because you think it could be kind of you know, really insensitive in today's you know, goggles of like how you represent something like that in a colonized place. But it seems like I'm enjoying the how kind of conscious they were about it. There was an episode about unions, like all these, you know, Hawaiians who worked for, you know, white hotel owners, like unionizing and stuff like that. So yeah, it's been pretty cool.
You know, the Human League did a song about Steve McGarrett.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
The song, The Circus of Death, like drops his name. McGarrett is trying to solve the mystery of, well, he's trying to catch the killer clown that runs the Circus of Death.
Oh wow. Well, another cool thing about that show too that I didn't really realize is that he's like state police, like he's an investigator. And so there's HPD, the Honolulu police, and so sometimes they kind of clash with Honolulu police because they kind of come and take over the case or whatever. But then it really harkens to like the modern CSI and NCIS, where like he even went in the lab, and like there was a woman lab person that was looking through a microscope and then shows him like what she found out, like some kind of forensic evidence or whatever. So it seems like it's kind of a precursor to those shows. Maybe that's why people liked it. It was kind of the science lab, you know, and he had this kind of gut feelings about stuff that he always seemed to get right.
Right. Don't they always?
Yeah.
That's one of the most misleading things. Have you ever read those, heard any of those studies where like cops always say that they can tell when people are lying and things like that in their hunches? And statistically, their hunches are wrong, than more wrong than flipping a coin.
Because they have these hunches, they have this confidence, and sometimes people even confess to things and stuff like that because the cops are so sure they're right.
Well, or twisting their arm so hard.
Yeah.
Not to say that I'm buying American police would ever do that, but I saw a movie once where that happened. Where they used coercion to bring a confession out of somebody.
Yeah. The Thin Blue Line is a good example.
I don't know that.
Oh, you don't know that one? That's a great movie. It's about a real case. It's a documentary about a real case. But, you know, they interview all these guys in jail, and the two guys got pulled over by the cops in Texas, and one of them shot one of the cops and killed him like out the window, and they drove off. And the other cop, they had been through a drive-thru, like a fast food drive-thru, and she was in the passenger seat of the cop car. And so it shows this really dramatic slow-mo of like when her partner gets dropped and she throws the shake, and it flies through the air in like slow motion. It's really good. And you know, on the diagrams of like the car one, car two, it shows where the shake was and stuff. It's really good.
Wow.
But they were interviewing the guy who got convicted, and like they just basically, you know, forced him to sign a confession, which, you know, he hadn't done it. And even like later, I think the guy who did do it, you know, said that he did it, and it was still like eventually the guy got out of jail. But this was like, you know, it happened in the 70s and the movie came out in the late 80s. So it was like this guy was in jail for a long time just because he was not that smart, and the cops like forced him to confess. And yeah, it was just bizarre. It's Errol Morris. I don't know if you know any of his stuff, and he's a really great documentarian, really stylized movies.
I was just talking to somebody who's at least an acquaintance, if not a friend, of one of the Memphis Three people.
Oh.
The so-called Satanists that got busted for ritual abuse of somebody and were in jail for a really long time too, and then got out. And I can't remember his name, of course.
One of those guys was named Damien, I think, which probably didn't help his case.
No, it wouldn't help with it.
Yeah.
Ethnic names never help. So, yeah. Have you been to any good shows lately?
The one thing I wanted to talk about, we went and saw Twin Temple the other night. Do you know that band?
Nope.
Oh, wow. They are a couple, like a married couple from L.A., and they are like a 100% satanic band, but their musical style they've chosen to relay their Satanism is like a doo-wop. And so they were kind of trying to take back Satanism from heavy metal. And so they, you know, their stage show is all this imagery. They're really like attractive couple. The music and the production is really good. They're also taking back, like, you know, they're like smash the patriarchy and kind of female power, because the lead singer is the female of the couple, and then the male plays the guitar. Yeah, they're just really dramatic, and they sing about just like, you know, kind of fun and funny songs. I was trying to get to the bottom of, like, you know, are they practicing Satanists, whatever that means, you know, and do they follow the Satanic Temple or the Church of Satan, or like the independent, and, you know, what are Satanists in general? Like, what is a Satanist? And so and we've talked about that somewhat before, but I thought this band was kind of another entry point to it. So, but I figured you probably had heard of them because they're getting pretty popular.
No, but I'm not up on the doo-wop scene or the satanic music scene per se. So
yeah, I think they've created their own doo-wop scene. Yeah, but you'll have to look them up. They're just the lyrics are great. Just you know, that it's not totally my style of music, but the lyrics are good and the production's really good. So, but like when I was watching that show, because that's the first time we've seen him, and Mariah is a big fan, and it's like, you know, they're getting the audience to chant along like Hail Satan, and you know, they drink from like a chalice with blood, and then they kiss, and it's all very like kind of mood and sexy, and so they're basically all in on the imagery and stuff. I don't know if they've had like protest stuff, but you would, you know, I don't know, in this day and age, maybe everyone's you know, according to some conspiracy theorists, like all the mainstream people are Satanists, so maybe like more deep Satanists are not even on their radar because they're just calling everyone Satanist. But yeah, you'll have to check it out.
No, I missed them here.
They've toured with a couple bands, but this is their first headlining tour, so they're still pretty relatively new.
Yeah, they're sort of towards the end of their tour. They must be from LA. They played DC in early October.
Okay. Yeah, we'll put some links in the show notes. They have some pretty good music videos and stuff too.
So I went to Reading, Pennsylvania to an art show there of fantasy illustrators. My friend Gabriella River is a Swedish artist who does kind of occult related art with there. And so I went up to go see her and see the show. It was pretty good. It was a nice drive up to Reading. But there were probably maybe 100 artists there, and lots of them do illustrations for Dungeons and Dragons and invented gaming scenarios. And a lot of them are World of Warcraft illustrators. And Forrest was there, that used to do the like sort of sword and sorcery covers. He did a lot of pulp paperback covers back in the day. Kind of similar stuff to what Frank Frazetta did. And he was there in person showing off a couple of his paintings, which is pretty amazing to see that stuff in person, because it really, you don't really think of like, you know, the pictures on cards as being fine art per se, but it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty impressive in person. Anyway, that was pretty cool. And River had just come back from a conference, Carl Abrahamson's conference, Visionary Medium, I think. It was 3 days of people showing films and talking about films and sort of their relation to psychoanalysis and the occult, I guess. So a bunch of my friends, you know, it's the same people that put on that show in Italy I did right before COVID. A lot of friends and allies showed up for that. I had to make a choice and wound up going to the UK to do that thing instead of going to Copenhagen for that thing. Life is full of difficult choices, as they say.
Yeah. And what do you think about Dungeons and Dragons? Just the resurgence or anything?
I don't know. I never super got into it personally when it was, you know, in the 80s heyday. So I don't know. I always thought it was kind of cheesy, but my dearly departed roommate and dear friend, David Bainham, whom you may remember from back
in the day. Oh, yeah, I remember that name.
AKA Legion, was really into it, was a certified dungeon master, and was really into this obscure D&D offshoot called Call of Cthulhu that was H.P. Lovecraft based. And it was kind of amazing, not least because there was no way you could survive the game. Because everybody, I mean, at some point, you know, you'd roll a 13 or whatever, and you'd end up like, you know, some sort of sucking, oozing mass would come out of some element, you know, would either, you know, smoke out of a picture frame, or like these tentacles would come out of the ocean or something. And, you know, I mean, the nameless horror would devour you, and that was bad.
Yeah.
Most of the time, I mean, one cool thing was it was blessedly short. You know, the campaign lasted maybe 2 or 3 sessions maximum. So the good thing was it didn't last forever like the ones on Stranger Things do.
Yeah.
But the resurgence, I don't know. I mean, it's analog and in person, or I suppose maybe it is. I don't know. Maybe everybody's doing it on TikTok. But I think there's a nostalgia for doing analog things in person.
Yeah, I'm pretty impressed that this many people are doing it. But I think that it's younger people. Like we played a little bit when I was a kid, and like my brother was a dungeon master. We get together with friends, but there was so much time spent on like getting your character all figured out and, you know, kind of designing the game, that by the time we started playing, we were like tired from all the snacks and drinks and stuff. So I don't remember it going on. You know, we kind of like petered out on those kind of things. But then we also played, there was one called Car Wars that was kind of fun.
I used to have like, that.
Ah, yeah. So you would design like a car instead of like a person, you know, and you would like fight other cars. So it was more like the Mad Max kind of thing. And then there was one called Top Secret or Secret Agent. I think it was Top Secret. And that was more like the campaign was a, like a James Bond kind of character. And so he was going through these scenarios trying to solve a thing or whatever. And so I think I like those branch off ones more than the dragons and, you know, orcs and wizards and stuff like that. But as far as I can tell, the people that are playing now are playing like versions of the original, you know, D&D itself. But they're like, I think they're like 20 somethings or 30 somethings, or maybe even teenagers. It's not people who did it like first wave and are getting back into it, I don't think. I think it's younger people who never experienced it in the first wave.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, was Car Wars designed by the same people? I thought that was a Steve Jackson thing.
Yeah, Steve Jackson. Yeah. But Car Wars was definitely Steve Jackson.
So Call of Cthulhu was somebody else, but I was into Steve Jackson because he did the Illuminatus little board game.
Oh thing. Yeah, okay, yeah. I think my brother had that too.
He did the Illuminatus, and he did. And I'm trying to think what other games he did, but I was sort of a fan of Steve Jackson stuff. It's unfortunate that guy's name is the guy that did the Hobbit movie, all the Lord of the Rings stuff is Steve Jackson too, but it's not the same.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we did the GURPS cyberpunk thing. That's what it was, because it had the Secret Service thought he had illegally accessed Bell South and uploaded a document that affected 911s, that it was a hacker tool. The game was a hacker tool.
Oh.
Which is kind of perfect in a way. So yeah, Car Wars. And then Illuminati and Hacker, Lord of the Fries, Game of Zombies, attempting to assemble orders in a fast food restaurant.
Wow. And those are all back, those are all 80s games?
Yeah, I think so, more or less.
Wow. I don't remember the Illuminati game, but I definitely remember my brother had it.
Yeah, I had Car Wars. It was in a tiny little package.
Like it's like a
package.
And yeah.
You had like Megabuck, which is one of many evil conspirators.
Yeah.
I suppose those things are worth kajillions of dollars now, the originals.
Yeah, they probably are. Kajillions of something.
Of masks of the Illuminati Megabucks.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, they're still around. Steve's still kicking.
Wow. Yeah, hopefully he can benefit something from the current wave of games. And there's a game I helped support, kind of invested in, called Cave Evil. And it was this guy Nate Hayden and Matt Brinkwell. There's several guys like in down in Littleton, and they were putting together this game. And so Nate's like a good board game designer, and he could design a game and like have it made in a kind of short run of like 500, and then go to Essen, Germany for this big game convention. And he did one called Finding Pablo, about Pablo Escobar. And so he went to Essen, I think he sold out of it. And so it's like, then you got to decide, like, are you going to, you know, reinvest and try to make more and try to sell it? Or do you move on and try to do some other game that you could go and maybe sell out of that first run? And is selling out of it, like, is there profit in that? Or is it like breaking even? So I think with this game Cave Evil, which is, you know, Dungeons and Dragons like, but it takes about 2 hours, I think, to totally complete it. So it's a much shorter game, but it's like the imagery is incredible. And like the artwork, some of the artwork is done by that Matt Brinkman, who does like a lot of heavy metal stuff. And Grux from Carolina Rainbow did some art. And like, it kind of boasts like the most pieces of unique art in any other game. Like, you know, they have whole stacks of cards, and there's no like, they're all different. So there's like a lot of artwork in there. But I invested in like them like going big with that one, and they've done like several reprints of it, and they've built expansion kits and stuff of it. And, it's cool. It's awesome. And they've been doing like lots of other games too.
I get exposed to games here and there with my kids, and I played this really neat board game one time called Mysterium.
Oh.
And it's kind of like Clue, but the cards are super cryptic. And somehow, you know, I think it's similar to Clue in that you stash you know, the so-and-so did such and such with the thing in this room kind of thing. But yeah, there are these really subjective kind of psychic cards that there's some kind of pattern between the cards that you can draw. And it turns out, you know, like there'll be something red in the card or something like that. And I think everybody has one piece of the puzzle. So each person sort of draws their connection in it. And I totally can't remember this. I only played it one time, but I really liked it because I liked the art and I liked how subjective it was. It wasn't really like most games that you play where it's pretty linear.
Yeah.
It was interesting because it forced you to kind of make these visual connections of color or shapes or something. Everybody would pick the connection to the thing that they had the clue for. And you'd have these cards and you'd have to make the connection between the cards, like find a common element in all the cards that you were given. And then that would be the clue, you know, to the thing. So somebody had to figure out how your mind was working.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And there, I can't think of a way that, you know, you'd ever get good at it per se if you weren't just kind of intuitive to start with.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun. Like there's no luck involved with it at all, except maybe guessing the connection between things. You know, there's no like is that roll of the dice or landing in a certain place or anything like that influences the game at all.
Oh, that's cool. And is that something your kids play like with friends and stuff or at school?
We don't have it. We played it at a friend's house one time. That's why I've only played it once. I keep wanting to buy it, but it's kind of expensive. I'm just like, I mean, we almost never play any of the games that we already have. And I'm like, do I really want to spend like, I think it's $50 or something. Do I really want to spend $50 on this box that's going to probably sit on my shelf and gather dust like all the other boxes do?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's out. So you've just been busy. You've been like Hawaii Five-O is sort of your guilty pleasure at the moment.
Yeah, it's like when I've kind of lost steam and I'm just like, I want to still stay up late because if I start going to bed early, I'll fall into a pattern of like going to bed early. So it's like my, you know, try to keep myself awake. And sometimes I can do stuff like on the computer while that's playing. Although then my neck gets sore because I'm like keep turning around watching it. You know, I'm like kind of watching it over my shoulder.
Well, that's
I need to put a mirror.
Go ahead.
And watch it in the mirror. Like if I put a mirror up on the other side of my computer screen, then I could see the TV like in, you know, like at the same time as my computer.
That was a thing at work for a while. It's not anymore. Like putting the rearview mirror on your computer. Did people do that at your work for a while?
I feel like I've seen that a couple times.
It was kind of a late 90s thing, I want to say. Where people would
you don't get startled.
People would put a convex mirror on there just so you could see if people were like shoulder surfing you or, you know, people wouldn't come up and you could see the boss coming.
Yeah.
And then, you know, yeah, like put your spreadsheet screensaver up.
Oh, man.
Remember there were actually even games that had a hotkey to put a fake spreadsheet up. You remember that?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Well, now I think there's some kind of keystroke generators so that, like, you know, as people are teleworking, it can like it seems like you're doing something. Like, I'm not sure exactly, you know, where that comes into play, but like maybe like on a network, your boss can see if you're actively doing anything on the computer. So there's, you know, without seeing what you're doing, they could see if you're doing something or not. So there's some kind of keep alive kind of key press generators.
Well, there's this wonderful company. I may have told you about this before, about WeebyTech. I feel like
that sounds familiar.
Before the mouse jiggler.
Oh yeah.
So forensics, it's a USB device that simulates mouse movement. And it's used like, I mean, the notional use for it is when you seize a computer. If it locks up, then you have to get the password. And if it's got on-disk encryption, you can't get to it. So the WeebyTech mouse jiggler, so you go into the caves in Bora Bora or whatever, Toradora, whatever it is. You go to those caves in Afghanistan and you like, you know, the special forces guy slits the Al-Qaeda guy's throat. And then like the tech dweeb jumps in and throws a WeebyTech mouse jiggler in there so that the computer doesn't lock up. And then they hook it up to a power supply. WeebyTech also made this thing where you could bypass the power. And I can't remember exactly how it worked. you could actually, like, without ever disrupting the power flow, you could switch over to their battery UPS power so that the power, the computer wouldn't shut down when it got unplugged or whatever, you know, if it was a desktop. It's really slick. I forget how it works. There's like some kind of, there's one kind of sleight of hand thing that you do at the very end where you flip the, it was really slick. He demoed it. Wow. It was, but it was kind of like, have you seen Mr. Bean person at all?
Not really. I think, I feel like I watched a Mr. Bean something on the plane one time.
So the very first Mr. Bean episode has an episode where he's wearing a suit and a tie. It's Rowan Atkinson, I think is his name. And he's wearing a full English, like the classic sort of English suit, right? He's at the beach and there's people on the beach and he didn't bring a towel and there's no place to go change. So somehow he puts a Speedo on over his clothes and then manages to take off his clothes underneath the Speedo, like lifting the legs up and doing this complete contortion act to get the thing. I think he ends up like, I can't remember how he does it, but it's incredible. Like he gets his pants and his boxers off.
Wow.
Somehow, like while his trunks are still on. And I think it might involve him taking the shorts off over his head, like getting the leg around his waist or something. I can't remember. It's insane. It's so weird. Like, and everybody's just like cheering him. You know, the audience, quite for once, is not canned laugh track. That's really amazing.
Hey, that's awesome. Which is Mr. Bean like still around? That was kind of like a 90s thing, right?
He's still around. He did like Johnny Danger or something that wasn't that great. Like Mr. Bean's Vacation is actually one of the funniest, you know, sort of slapstick movies I've ever seen.
Wow.
And Dad pulling on the floor. It starts off with him like in France. And he can't read the menu because he's an English pig and he doesn't speak at all. So he's just like, you know, give me that. And the waiter's like, okay, oui, oui, monsieur, and comes back. And it's like raw seafood in the shell. Like it's like this lobster and he doesn't know how to eat it. And so he starts breaking pieces off of it and putting it in this woman's purse.
Oh, man.
it's just the facial expressions and the sort of guttural noises that he makes while he's doing that are just epic.
Wow.
Like there's something where he's simultaneously sort of repellent and dreadful. It's kind of amazing. He's like so repellent and yet sympathetic and hilarious. He's just a thoroughly like unpleasant looking and behavior, like his body language and his mannerisms and everything like that, are just so odd.
Yeah, it's all kind of awkward and stuff.
Yeah, he's just so peculiar that you're really kind of, you know, he's definitely neurologically diverse. But and then there was one, just like Chanda, my wife is a huge fan of his and watches everything. There was one where he's a house sitter that was pretty good. And I think he spoke in that. Like I prefer him when he doesn't speak.
Yeah, yeah. It's like you can kind of sight orient it. Because I think I remember I was watching it on the plane with no sound, or like watching it's like someone else's screen or something. But it's so sight kind of sight gaggy that you know what's going on.
That's actually, I mean, that's my beef. Like the thing you were talking about having to turn around while you're doing the computer. That's kind of my beef with film and video, is that it has to be good, because if it's going to engage all my senses, like you have to sit in one place and you have to watch something kind of beginning to end. I mean, if it's a reasonable length, you kind of have to sit there and watch it beginning to end, and you're planted there. It's awkward to take breaks and you can't do anything else. You can't read a book. You can't do stuff on the computer. You can't listen to music because it's taking both. Like, you can read a book and listen to music, or you can listen to music and iron, you know, or something. But video forces you to kind of be fully engaged with it. And I always just feel ripped off, like really ripped off, if something isn't good, if they capture me like that, or if they overly manipulate my emotions too, because it's so immersive. You know what I mean? If it doesn't come out good somehow, you know, if it does, like you go on a roller coaster ride on something and they like, you know, play these combinations of sad camera angles with tragic music or something, and they manipulate your emotions. And then it turns out that the person you're crying about is a schmuck. You just feel ripped off. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And that just sets the bar very high for me for cinema, shall we say.
Yeah. And I definitely don't watch movies while doing other stuff. Like, I know people do that. Like, oh, I watched that movie while doing housework or whatever. It's like, I definitely engage myself more in movies, but TV or something like Law and Order or something, I can do other stuff and kind of, I'm getting the gist of the story, but I'm not so caring as much about the visuals.
It's funny. I hate watching cop shows anymore. Yeah, well, I guess I watch cop shows as movies or as series sometimes. You kind of can't avoid them. But I know, considering what I do for a living and everything, I'm not super sympathetic to the police. Never have been.
Yeah.
They've never been sympathetic to me, so I don't really see why I should return that unconditionally.
Yeah, exactly.
They shut down a lot of my shows.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the movie Carnival of Souls?
It sounds really familiar.
60s, black and white, 1962. It came up this week because my boss was talking about it. My boss was up in Fort Collins, and he was like, oh, there's a retrospective playing at this, it's called Fort Collins Discovery Center. It's a like a hands-on kind of museum kind of place, but they also have like a planetarium and a theater, or maybe the planetarium is the theater. But he's like, I'm sure you know this movie that they're talking about, but the director's from Fort Collins. He went to Fort Collins High School, and so I didn't know what he was talking about. I was like, I don't know any movie of anyone in Fort Collins. But once we looked it up to see what the movie was, and I was like, oh yeah, that's one of my favorite movies. He's like, oh really? And he was gonna go see it. He, you know, because I was so kind of struck by it. But I was out of town for the weekend, so I couldn't go. But I don't think I've ever seen it on the big screen. But it's just a really striking imagery, kind of like a ghost story. Starts out kind of similar to Psycho in the way. It's got like this blonde woman who is an organ player, and she moves to a small town and gets a job at the church. She's not religious, but she gets a job as like the church organ player. But it was filmed. So the guy was from Windsor, Colorado, which is up near Fort Collins. He went to Fort Collins High. And he's the director and the main, aside from the lead actress, he's like the main kind of male actor. It's just like, it's really striking and cool use of black and white film. It's filmed at the Salt Flats in Utah. Mm-hmm. There was this this place called the Salt Air Pavilion, and there was an amusement park. And so the movie's kind of centered around this abandoned amusement park. I'll probably like anything about an abandoned amusement park, whether it's a Scooby-Doo episode or like a 60s movie. You know, it's a captivating subject for me. But then I actually was at Salt Air Pavilion, the pavilion part's still there, in like the 90s, I think in the late 90s, Butthole Surfers were playing at Red Rocks in Colorado, and they were playing on my birthday. And so I was in contact with them, and I was like saying something like, oh, because they were playing at the Salt Air Pavilion on my birthday and then playing Red Rocks maybe the next night. And I was like, oh, I'm thinking about coming out to the show or something. I was like, they said, oh, buy a one-way ticket to Salt Lake, and then you can ride with us back to Denver. And so that was when they had a tour bus. That was when they like they had graduated to be big enough to have a tour bus, but then all their extra money went to the tour bus. So you still don't make any money on tour, you know. It's like every band's dream to be big enough to have a bus. So they got the bus, and then
where did they play? Where did they play in Denver that time?
That was at Red Rocks.
Oh, right. You said that like four times. Sorry. Wow. They headlined Red Rocks.
Was it headlining? I don't know if it was a headlining show. I feel like it probably was, but I don't remember who else played, now that you mention it. I think they played
Stone Temple Pilots, 1993.
Ah, yeah, okay. Stone Temple Pilots, yeah. And I think they played with Firehose or somebody in Utah also. I don't know if that was
They played with Firehose in Red Rocks too.
Okay, so that was the tour. So yeah, that was my first time, my first and only time, like sleeping on a bus. You know, they call them the stoned pimple toilets. That was the Butthole Surfers' name for Stone Temple Pilots. I don't know they if it's were, an exact anagram, but close.
Gibby was clever. Gibby is clever, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your best Gibby story? Have we told our Gibby stories before?
I don't think we have.
Brightwig.
Oh, that was
Smiley's laundromat. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. You did talk about that.
Yeah.
That was a recent episode.
Yeah. The last time, well, maybe not. It probably wasn't the last time, but I saw him at the, what's that place called now? The Fillmore, but it was Mammoth Gardens still at the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They played Mammoth for Doug Kaufman. They were headlining.
Yeah, that Warlock Pinchers played that.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So you were backstage probably. Somebody brought a smoked salmon for Gibby as a present. And the first thing he did was eat the meat right above the eye socket. And he's like, yep, that's the best part.
we played with them. We played with them in Salt Lake City. So we played with them originally at Glenn Miller Ballroom a couple years before, or like a year before, and became quick friends and corresponded with them and traded T-shirts and stuff. And then I don't know if we played with them again in Denver yet, or they were coming to Denver, but we weren't on the show. So we wrote to folks in Salt Lake and we got on the show in Salt Lake. And then Gibby was like, well, you guys are playing with us in Denver too, right? And we're like, no, they never called us back or whatever. And he's like, oh no, you're playing with us in Denver. He's like, just come to the show. You're playing with us. So we went to the show and they demanded that we play with them. It was totally awesome. And that was before Doug Kaufman was totally like into having us play all the time. Cause at some point, I think the year after that, or maybe right after that, he must have realized that we had a pretty good following. We opened up for Dead Milkman and Mudhoney and stuff. Like Doug Kaufman was using us for all sorts of shows that is like to kind of bump up the ticket sales. But yeah, my what I remember from that show at backstage at the Mammoth was Gibby had this apple and he poured lighter fluid. He like poured out the apple and poured lighter fluid in it and like made like kind of like a candle. And then, so after it's like burning for a while, it becomes like this mushy thing. And he wrapped it in a towel and smashed it against the wall. And it makes like this popping noise. And we're just like, wow, Gibby's so cool. He does the coolest weird stuff that doesn't make any sense. And he also went out because we were like touring. Like that was like our album was called Deadly Kung Fu Action. And we sampled lots of Kung Fu. And Gibby went on this whole like kind of vocal rant about Kung Fu. He's like, you Kung Fu some of the people some of the time, but you Kung Fu all the people all of the time. He's like, I Kung Fu you. And like he just kept going, you know. It's like he does those kind of weird vocal puzzles with himself.
He's one of the most iconic characters to come out of the 80s, early 80s punk scene, I would say. Alternative music in general. It's a shame. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm looking at Wikipedia right now, and there's sort of like he sort of just loses steam around 2015 or something. He was a guest vocalist on a Mastodon song, which is kind of surprising.
Oh, wow.
And he's an artist, but it's hard to say what he's doing now. Somebody told me he's in New York now.
Yeah, I think I mentioned that last time we talked about him. He's married to a lawyer.
Sounds like Harley Flanagan, which I think I said last time, too.
There's somebody's doing a documentary about Butthole Surfers that I
of course they are
into, and it seems like it's like long overdue. I mean, there's been books and stuff about them, but I watched like a trailer or something, and I think I donated money to GoFundMe or something, but Jeff Pincus is not seen in it anywhere.
Documentary's out.
No, I think they had like a just footage, like a trailer or footage or something. And you know, you see quotes from all the different members and people who played in it throughout the years, but like Pincus was just not seen in it. And I think somebody told me he didn't want to be involved or something. But then that's weird if you erase someone out of the history like that. Like he was around since pretty much the beginning.
Oh yeah, like, I'm looking at his.
Like picture. They had various members throughout the years, but he was in it. You know, probably 99% of the time. So, but then he's been in and out of town. He tours a lot, just playing solo. He plays like a banjo.
Who's that, Pincus?
And yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty fun. He plays barefoot.
Where does he live? He
plays banjo and sings. He was living in like South Texas, but I think he moved to somewhere else now, like Asheville or somewhere. But yeah, he had an album called Keep on the Grass. He's been through town a couple times with other bands. And yeah, he plays, he's got lots of effects, but he plays like banjo and just sings and stuff. It's the real funny, funny kind of caricature type songs. It's good.
Oh, and he's got the, he's doing stuff with the Melvins now too.
Oh yeah, he hasn't been in the Melvins for a little while, but he played with them several years ago. When I went on tour with them in like 2016, he was their bass player. So I went on tour with them for like a week doing my PowerPoint presentations. So that was really fun.
What were your PowerPoint presentations?
So that's my project called Get Your Going. Started out as a sing-along project where I just sing along with obscure music like Waffle House songs or safe driving songs. And then I started just doing PowerPoints about various subjects, but I would never talk. I would never reveal what it was about until I started. And I never repeat one. And so I've done it for years, probably since like the early 2010s. I think 2010 was the first one. And so I was the Melvins were playing in Denver on my birthday. And I don't really care about my birthday, but I was like, hey, you guys are playing on my birthday. You should have me open up for you. I was writing to texting with Buzz, and he was like, why don't you just go on tour with us doing the PowerPoints? I was like, okay, that sounds great. So I flew out to Minneapolis with my projector and my collapsible movie screen. I did a PowerPoint every night. Just toured with them back to Denver.
How did you put the PowerPoints together if you had a different one every night?
In that case, I violated my rule of never repeating one because I was out of state, I guess. I picked like some of my favorites, and then I redid some of the ones that I had done. But then when I got back to Denver, I did PowerPoint Roulette, where Jeff Pincus like found a PowerPoint online just by searching and then downloaded it and then put it on my laptop. And then I start presenting it having never seen it before, which I've done sometimes when I'm feeling particularly lazy or busy.
So
I just do a PowerPoint that someone downloads from the internet.
So what are the PowerPoints about? Like what do you?
So I did one about blood, where I show like cute characters like in Japan that are like at blood drives. They have mascot characters for blood. Talk about blood types. I did a blood analysis of Slayer by counting the frequency of the word blood in Slayer songs. And it was something like 24% of Slayer songs contain the word blood. Stuff like that. I just come up with goofball facts. And then like I did one about sublingual braces, which was something I was opening up for a band called Tinsel Teeth. And so I was looking up like braces related stuff, and sublingual braces are braces on the inside of your teeth,
yeah,
which I had never heard of that before. So it seems like really bad for your tongue, like it cuts your tongue up. But I did one for Record Store Day where I solved the physics problem of the bug on the record player. So in like college physics, there's like a bug on a record player, and he's like walking. Maybe it's a CD player in the more modern times or something, but there's a bug in the middle of a record, and he's walking in a straight line, but of course the record's going around, so he's going around, but the bug just to him is just going straight. And at some point, based on the coefficient of friction of the bug's feet and the record, the centripetal force is enough to fling the bug off of the record.
Right. As
so the
walks,
question, like, yeah, so how far out does the bug get on the record before it gets flung off? And there's other things like you could say, like there's other questions that would get asked in those, like how far did the bug travel? And so like you have to consider his circular motion as like a coil going out, and like, so how, you know, how much space did he move and stuff? So that one I actually had like a, called a bamboo, and it was like a drawing tablet for your computer. And so I did a PowerPoint where it's actually doing the math live, you know, drawing the equations. And typically that project, I'm an opening act for bands. So it's kind of made to fail. Like nobody wants to see some guy do a PowerPoint instead of a band.
So do people boo you, or like how is it in comparison to like, you know, early Butthole show or early Pinchers shows?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, people would definitely boo, or just not so much boo, but just like yell, like play some fucking music or, you know, something. They're just right. Some people hate it. Some people are attentive and they come up after and like, oh, that was actually, I learned some stuff during that. You know, it's kind of
wow,
funny.
They need to get a life, those people.
Yeah. No, it really is. It's entertaining. And it's great for the other bands because I don't take up any, you know, I just set up in front.
Yeah,
I
you have no production. You have no production.
It's no like, band wants to.
Right. It's like getting a banjo player to open for you or whatever. Like, or
yeah. Like, someone who doesn't take up any space and nobody wants to play first. So, because like to me, going first before some people got there is great because the people get there later and the people who saw it, they're like, you're never going to believe what you missed. Like some guy had a laser pointer and he was like talking about Waffle House or something, you know. It's like it's so funny out. So it's as entertaining to have missed it than it is to have seen it, because to hear about it secondhand, it doesn't even sound real, you know. So it's a really funny project, but it kind of keeps me in the music scene without being in a band, you know, because I still get to perform at these concerts. I gotta go on tour with the Melvins, you know. It's like, it's pretty funny.
So I'm gonna shift gears now.
All right.
And talk like go heavy. Well, maybe not, because you were kind of geeking out there. So I've been reading, I keep talking about David Graeber, and I haven't really gone deep on him for a while, but he's this, what is he? He's not an anthropologist. He's an anthropologist, and who died a couple years ago, like in the peak of COVID, and was an anarchist. We've talked about him a little bit, about debt and bullshit jobs, I think. And maybe the utopia of rules, where he talks about why don't we have flying cars. And then his most recent book is called The Dawn of Everything, which is like this history of this prehistory of humans. And he starts off asking, where do we get our idea of freedom? He starts talking about, I think it was Rousseau, who sort of wrote about the idea that he was sort of maybe the first person that wrote about the rights of man or something like that. And like the return of nature, the idea that people that were uncivilized, you know, by European standards were somehow more free. And so he starts off with like, where did we get the conception of liberty in the first place? Like we talk about it a lot. Where did it come from? And his thesis is that it came from Native Americans. And he goes through this whole thing of like the notion of freedom and democracy and human rights and all of that stuff began when Europeans started talking to the indigenous people of the Americas. And the indigenous people, who were like a lot of them, like especially sort of like the sort of eastern seaboard people, like the Five Nations and the Algonquins and folks like that. I'm not gonna drop names because I can't pronounce them and I don't remember them either. But basically they were really, really, really like apparently indigenous people are incredibly good at logic and rhetoric, because the way that their society worked was you had to like, it wasn't consensus. You had the right to sit anything out. So if you wanted something to happen, you had to get everybody involved. Like if you wanted to go to war with a neighboring tribe, or you wanted to like, you know, go hunt buffalo or something, you had to convince enough people to make it viable, because people could just sit it out. The state, you know, so-called, had no right of coercion over people whatsoever. So these people were incredibly persuasive and logical and could appeal to your emotions and appeal to your logic and appeal, like were really, really, really like, and so these monks would come and try to convert them, and they would just be like, that's a crappy argument, man. They'd be like, you know, you're God's servant. And they're like, why would I want to serve a God like that? And the priests were just, you know, the what do you call them? The missionaries were just flummoxed. They didn't know what to do about it. And the Indians were just like, you know, I call them Indians, this one sentence. They would be like the first Nations folks or whatever would be like, why do you follow this king? And they'd be like, well, it's his right to be king. And they're like, what makes him king? Like, what makes him better than you? Like he can tell you what to do. And no, like the Europeans couldn't answer it. And so there started being this trickle back of like accounts of people talking to these, you know, to these savages. And these savages are crazy. Like, you know, they don't even like they don't even, you know, because most of the stuff was super biased and went through kind of a censorship process, you know, probably self-censorship. But anyway, so it starts off like that. And then it goes into how like we have this model that that the way things are was inevitable, and that, you know, people went from hunter-gatherers to you know, agricultural societies to these sort of kingships, you know, from you know, bands of nomadic gathering people to like, you know, sort of chieftain tribe things to like more kind of cities and stuff like that. And that it was this kind of linear progression into kings and then empires and stuff. And he completely debunks that, like goes through, and there's 150 pages of references in the back. Like the bibliography is 150 pages of this book. Mm-hmm. And they just, him and this guy, David Wengrow, just systematically debunk the whole idea and are like that a lot of societies like did all of those things. Like we're nomadic, would travel around similarly, but also that like agriculture, a lot of agriculture was really laid back, where it's pretty, they're pretty sure there's a lot of evidence that humans would plant things in the wild, would like nurture sort of stands of crops that they wanted to have, and then would come and harvest them, you know, sort of at their leisure. And they would do this kind of lazy farming around like along like in floodplains and stuff like that, where there'd be some water and there'd be pools of water left over. It would stay wet and they wouldn't have to irrigate it, but it was like fertile soil. But they would just, they were sort of opportunistic farmers and would kind of cruise around and do that. But while having, some were like sort of like bands, and some of them were like really highly developed kind of kingdoms that were still hunter-gatherers. And, you know, that there weren't like, you know, it ties back to religion. Anyway, it's really fascinating. So that
wow.
That got me into him, and I started buying more of his stuff. So then I bought this book called On Kings, a collection of essays on what kings are like. And that was really intense because it goes into this whole, like he kind of, like that one, they're kind of debunking the idea of like, of sacred kings, the idea of kings of being like emanations of God, somehow of having some kind of divine authority. And they sort of collectively, they take different opinions, but it all kind of goes into the same direction that kings were like not only like but they also were super fragile, and that they were also very subject to being killed as much as they were to kill. And that part of the thing about like one of the hallmarks of kings is their willingness, not just their power to do so, but their willingness to exercise sort of irrational violence and power. Like to like there's a lot of sort of king as transgressor kind of stories about them, like especially in like sort of you know, quote, primitive societies, unquote, you know, in animist and tribal societies where the king would come from another place. Like there's this whole thing of the stranger king, and the king wouldn't be allowed. And you can see this in European history too, is a lot of the people, like when a king would get deposed, like say in England or something, they would bring some king over from Germany to run England, you know, and that's how the how this group of inbred people started taking over England, whatever, like the Georges or whatever, what are they called? What's the name of these people? The kings and queens of England. They have a Windsor, but they had another George the Third, whatever, that the Georges had. They brought William and Mary over from Holland or something. But like it's a common theme where they would bring this stranger king in to rule them. And a lot of these people would be like, they'd be married to their cousins, or they would have killed their mother or raped their sister, or like they'd be married to their sister, and all of these crazy sort of transgressive things. And I think the idea was that they had like sort of that they had this power to be able to, that by being able to transcend sort of human law, that gave them a right to an un, to an otherwise like unacceptable level of arbitrary power over people.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know much about like royal kings and history like that. Like just never learned that much about it.
I'm into it, but the thing that's interesting is like as I was reading one of those books, I guess it was as I was starting on King, I realized that like there's a theme because he wrote about a lot of different things. He wrote about jobs. He wrote about, you know, kind of, you know, the future and about anarchism. And he invented the, you know, he came up with the term we are the 99% and was, you know, probably the ideological force behind the Occupy movement. And what I realized is really what his thing is about is it's about leverage, about how people gain, about the way that groups of people gain leverage or reduce the leverage that's on them. You know, not so much about power as about the ability to shift the needle on something about the way that humans get leverage over other humans, whether it's economical or whether it, you know, economic or, you know, based on force or coercion or, you know, charisma or whatever, religion, but how that, like what the dynamic is that makes that happen. And it's really fascinating. Anyway, I'm
still, and does it,
go ahead.
Does it repeat itself? And like something like Tutankhamun, the boy king, they're like, so the Egyptian kings versus the British monarchies, like, is it the,
he doesn't talk about,
is it comparable? So
he mostly, like, it's mostly really, like, the On Kings thing is really anthropological. It talks about the way, and so it's complicated, and I don't remember the details that well. I kind of bookmarked a lot of stuff, but I didn't write anything down. But he kind of, they talk mostly about tribal stuff. The only thing, they talk about the Inuit, and they talk about these tribes in Madagascar. And they're really interesting. They're the ones that like take the dead out of their graves every so often and like sit them in chairs and entertain them.
Yeah, Mariah told me about that.
For a day. Like he spent time with those people. Graeber did. That was his his doctoral thesis, was spending a lot of time with them or something like that. That was kind of bread and butter. Is, you know, that's what he cut his teeth on as an anthropologist. So he talks about them, and then they talk about these African tribes, like West African kind of slave coast tribes, and how, I mean, there's just arbitrary stuff. Like apparently, like in the 1920s or 30s or something, like this stuff isn't, like, I mean, a lot of the anthropological stuff isn't old on those folks. And like there's this one king, to show off, to like to show his power to foreigners, he would just pull out his rifle and like shoot four or five people in his village, just arbitrarily, just to show how he had this arbitrary power over life and death over his subjects. Yeah. I think they wound up killing and eating him, but
yeah. So on a related topic, our last podcast in our teaser, you said you were talking about going to the UK, I think, and you said you went to go see the Queen's flowers, but then in the episode you never mentioned that again.
Well, why would I mention
that? Because that was now? Like right when the I don't know. I was always kind of left wondering because that was right when the Queen died, I guess. So like, what's your take on the modern British monarchy?
Charles is a schmuck. Everybody knows that.
Yeah,
I think I don't like him. Never have. I don't know. It seems to me like, I mean, there's two kinds of monarchy in Europe. One are like, you know, were hung from lampposts in the 20s, you know, somewhere between the 1700s and the 1920s, they were hung from lampposts. And the other ones are these kind of declawed sort of symbolic people that don't really have much reach or power or, you know, connection to the people. And somehow the British monarchy escaped both of those routes, and there's still these like really rich, super entitled people. I think they're horrible. Like I hate all of them. I hate Harry. I hate Diana. I hate, like, I mean, I can't stand any of them. I, you know, may I rot in hell or whatever. Like spam me. But like, I mean, I think it's horrible that somebody can be raised in that family with that kind of entitlement and then like get in a fight with them and then start spilling the beans and then use it as leverage just to do a startup, which I think is just absolutely nauseating. The whole Harry and Meghan piece, like William or whatever his name is ghastly. Like they're all just ghastly.
Yeah, I just have never, I've never had any interest in it. Like I don't really even get it. It just seems, yeah, entitled is a good thing. There's all this like, properness to it, and like,
I mean, they're really entitled. Like, I mean, people say that people like us are entitled, you know, but we're not. Like, we're so not entitled. Those guys are entitled, and girls, they're entitled. Yeah. Like, they were born into this thing, and like in this way that's like unescapable, and that they can't even. I mean, they're so entitled they can't even leave. It's like being in the mafia or something like that. Like they can't leave. I mean, not that you'd want to, because they're the richest people in England. But I don't know. It's and then the American fascination with it. I mean, I don't know how long your people have been on this continent, but like, I mean, people here. I mean, our country was founded like on the basis of like kicking those entitled shitbags out. And now, like,
yeah, now we're still like and now putting him on this like, pedestal.
It's disgusting. It's disgusting.
I did like, I watched a movie. I probably wouldn't have gone seen it because I didn't really care too much about Princess Diana. But there's a movie, Spencer, that came out in 2021 that was, it played at the Denver Film Festival. It was like the opening night film or the closing night film. So I go to those a lot of times because it's the fanfare of the festival and stuff. But it was a great movie. I mean, it was all about Diana just not fitting in to that bullshit stuff. That was, you know, she wasn't part of it. And like, she kind of rebelled against it, but it also drove her mad probably too. So it was like, you know, and she ends up dying young because of it. So I kind of got interested in that sense of just the descent towards it. But yeah, I really don't know much about it. I don't, never cared.
If it, I thought Johnny Rotten media, was... I mean, if it wouldn't have been for media, she would have been okay. You know, like she would have been a fine princess, you know, in the old days when there was no television and everybody wasn't following her around and stuff. Like she could have just sat in her palace and, you know, moped or written bad poetry or, you know, done tatting or something like Marie Antoinette did, you know, because, I mean, I don't think Marie Antoinette wasn't popular and she didn't really fit in. And would have been fine if it wouldn't have been for the French Revolution.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I'm sure there were lots of, you know, there have been lots of royal people and, you know, the house is big enough. I mean, they, you know, and they have all these different palaces. Like they didn't really have to be together except for super important moments of state.
Yeah.
You know, parades.
That does sound miserable.
Blessing of
Christmas. The movie's kind of centered around going to visit on Christmas and like just the stuffiness of the people and the prim proper or whatever. But then you have John Lydon, who totally like recanted his whole God Save the Queen Sex Pistols era as like he mourns the Queen like publicly.
Yeah, I mean it's not surprising kind of given his trajectory. I'm not sure where he pivoted, you know. I'm not sure what point in time he became kind of, you know, that kind of guy.
Yeah, well, yeah, and he's like a Trump supporter, and it's like, you know, it's like, it's, I guess it's still rebellion in some way or whatever. But I just thought he made a career on like hating on the Queen, and then he like sent her off with well wishes when she died.
Yeah, yeah, and he never got a knighthood out of it.
Yeah,
I mean that's kind of one of the coolest things is that Mick Jagger accepted his knighthood and Richards refused his. Like Mick is a sir and Keith Richards refused it. Said, no, I don't want it. I don't want to be one of those. That's what we were always against. Fuck that. Which is pretty awesome. Well, I mean that takes a lot of courage, you know. I mean a lot of actual conviction. You know, I mean if somebody offered me something big like that, right? Some big prize from some institution that I really didn't believe in. Most of my friends, or you know, most of the people whose counsel I trust, would be take it. Maybe you can change it from the inside, or you've earned it, and it doesn't matter. Like it's just a thing, you know. Like get over it. Like don't be petty. you know, just roll with it. Like, it's a cool thing. You paid your dues. Like, take it. And to say no,
yeah,
because it's wrong. Like, because I've never believed in that. And I still don't, even though it's really not to my benefit not to take it. I refuse. I don't want to be part of that.
Yeah, that is.
And I don't think very many people have done that in the 20th century. If you did it in the 15th century, you got beheaded. But we live in a degraded time.
Yeah.
So I read another book by this guy named Danny Nemu, N-E-M-U. And it's called Neuroapocalypse. And it's one of the most thought-provoking books I've read in a really long time. He was the final speaker at the Trans States Conference that I talked at in Hampton. And he did a really cool thing there, was he started talking about mycelium, so the stuff that forms mushrooms, the network of cells or whatever it is. And he started talking about how they have some kind of intelligence, like they're able to solve problems at a simple level. They're able to like grow around things.
Yeah.
And things like that. They're able to solve mazes and to find the shortest distance between two points and to like, and also they have memory. Like apparently when you show them the answer to a puzzle, it remembers it and can solve the puzzle again more quickly than it did the time before. And so he used all of these things. And he used it as a metaphor for magic, but also for humans working together, like that humans form these relationships and that together these colonies of humans do the same things, like behave that mirror the behavior of mycelium in these situations. And that if you feed them, then they do certain things and they'll do certain things to get towards reward and whatnot. So then he started talking about how he was part of this ayahuasca community in Brazil. And he talked about how, you know, mycelium kind of relates to that and how the intelligence of it, like, is a cellular intelligence and has perhaps a cellular wisdom that it can impart to humans and whatnot. And then goes into like how the water there has been ruined by people who didn't behave like mycelium does and work towards a common good and in a way that like find their food in an efficient way. And then, so then it wound up being kind of a pitch to donate money to this charity that he had built to clean up the water table in the part of Brazil that his family, you know, that his ayahuasca tribe lives. And then, As a send-off, he was like, so I have a bunch of slime mold culture at home, and I'm going to give each of you, anybody that wants to do this, we're going to do a sigil together. We're going to, like, make a wish. So make a wish and chew these oats. Like, he brought a bunch of, like, raw oats, and you chewed the raw oats until they were a pulp, and then you spread them onto a piece of corrugated paper of cardboard, like, with one end pulled off so it looks like lasagna, you know how you, and so you spit out the oats mixed with your saliva onto the corrugated paper and then put it in a bag with your address, and he's going to inoculate it with slime mold and mail it back to us. So and we'll see what pattern it is. Whatever pattern it grows in will be this sigil that you have that focuses whatever energy you have that's based around our interaction and our interaction and my wish that I made while we were interacting, and the group mind, you know, sort of hive thing together. And everyone will be different because it's interacting with, you know, different, you know, saliva with different genetics. So anyway, it's like, it was this really cool thing. So that's Danny Nemu. And he's like one of the most articulate, like he spoke off the cuff in this amazingly articulate, erudite and yet like personable kind of witty way. He's really, really good. So anyway, I wasn't going to buy his book because it seemed like it was one of those kind of books about, you know, drugs and blah, blah, blah. Like, yeah, whatever. Been there, done that. You know, I read Robert Anton Wilson when I was young, you know, and all the LSD stuff. Like, yeah. But
anyway, it turns out to be the most fascinating book. It's notionally written around the book, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. And Danny's Jewish, and so I don't know, I don't think he practices, but he knows, he's a linguist, a quite good linguist, because he knows Japanese, Chinese, and Hebrew, and English, for sure, and maybe other languages, too. But he goes into, like, what do the words of creation mean, and talks about, like, so superficially, it's about the Bible and the way that the brain works. Like, it starts off talking about language. Like about the Bible and language and the difference between like the thing that you observe, like the, like an event and the words that we use to describe the event and how the words never exactly match the event. And he uses, you know, the creation, you know, the first few sentences of the Bible as evidence of that, of how it translates into various languages, how the Hebrew captures it in an entirely different way, like that just the plurals and the singulars and the nouns and the descriptions and all that stuff are completely different in Hebrew than they are in Greek, and then again different than they are in Latin, and they completely translate into different ideas, and that probably the Hebrew didn't really capture the essence of the thing to begin with, but that it's much more subjective because gender isn't there, and like there's plurals, there's like gender neutral plurals being used for God and earth and things like that. That nuance doesn't get captured in any other language in single words. But so he talks about like how language works, and then it evolves into how brains work, like into the different parts of the brain. And then he uses a different part of the Bible as a metaphor for that. So while he's doing that, he's setting it up that the Bible was written, that it was revised, that there were multiple revisions, you know, because of what we know about the Dead Sea Scrolls and stuff. There's actually, and it's not something that I'm terribly familiar with because I'm not interested in the Bible, and I'm not interested in, you know, and I mean, I've never been interested in the Bible, and I don't like that tradition, like the Judeo-Christian one has always been one that I've sort of not been interested in. And also, I mean, that history isn't generally like when you go to, you know, Bible class or whatever in church, or you read a book about, like, it's not really, I mean, you always think of the Bible as being this thing that like somebody wrote down a long time ago and it was like one thing and it stayed that way, you know, at least the Old Testament. The New Testament, you know, that there's some things, you know, or that the translations changed, but you don't really think about like how the Hebrew Bible came to be written in its, you know, in what we consider its, you know, the Torah, how that was written.
Yeah.
So anyway, he digs into that a little bit. Like as he's going, he's starting to build up this case that the Bible was written in different parts and that the names that the Hebrews used for God change over time. And that there's like, they're actually like in the Bible, the thing that we think of as God Almighty in the Bible is actually like five or six different names, and that they're very distinct personalities. And he starts digging into the different personalities of these gods and how one of them is like an authoritarian, arbitrary motherfucker. Like Jehovah is just this, you know, who created the world is just this totally arbitrary dude who can go either way. Like he doesn't care if like Jews die, Jews live, like kids, whatever. He's completely arbitrary and kind of brags about it. And then there's like Elohim, and that seems to be like, maybe it's Elohim is the creator and he's arbitrary. But anyway, there's like one that's this just arbitrary bossy god that sometimes like, whether, even if you're nice, like the guy that tortured, not Jonah, who was the one? Was it Jonah that they, no, I can't remember now. I don't know the Bible very well, but like,
yeah,
he just arbitrarily like would test people that were faithful to him to see if he could break them, like, and would have bets with the devil to see if he could break people, and talks about how, yeah, because it was Jehovah, it was the person that said, don't go into the garden, don't eat this fruit. And it's like, it totally set Adam and Eve up.
And then the snake was actually telling the truth. It was like, who the fuck is this to tell you not to eat this shit? Like, why don't you eat it? He doesn't want you to eat it because you'll know. And it turns out that they did know. Like, they were like, we're naked and we're like living in this place. And God was like, the only way you could know that is if you ate the fruit. Get out of here now. Like, not, yeah, because it said you can become like gods if you do this. And so, and I'm kind of messing up the, like, I'm not getting this entirely straight, but I hopefully I'm getting it straight enough to make somebody want to read it. It's really, yeah. Really good. So then he goes into like how brains work. And then he goes into like how monkeys work, like how monkeys organize things and how like there's these different levels of intelligence with monkeys and apes. And apparently, like, monkeys have tails. I didn't really realize the difference between monkeys and apes before I saw that. But monkeys have tails and apes don't. And apes, there's only one kind of monkey that maybe as smart as apes. And I can't remember what kind, but like chimps and like orangutans and gorillas and stuff like that are all apes. And they're smarter than monkeys. And he kind of goes into that for a reason to show kind of like how there's definitely this kind of range between the creatures of the earth that are able, you know, like capability gap between different orders of animals. And then somehow it goes into a kind of a Graeber kind of thing almost. So there's these different personalities. So one of the gods is a creator, and one of them is this, you know, like a disinterested kind of creator dude. And another one is this kind of like power tripping, like arbitrary sort of tribal guy, you know, almost like a like one of those kings we were talking about that just kind of randomly shoots people just to show his power. And then there's another one that's like the defender of Israel. That's like his thing is like, Israel is my chosen people, and they're like, the Israelites are the people that'll do it. That, you know, like, this is the team I'm backing, and I'm your guy, and like, you know, I'll make the rivers part and the seas blaze and, you know, all this stuff. And then he goes into this whole thing about the Ten Commandments. There's actually three stories in the Bible about God giving commandments. And one of them is like 30 commandments, and one of them is like 24 or something. And he goes into the Kabbalah of why those numbers are important, and talks about like how sort of dumb and arbitrary some of those rules are, and how they're like total tribal thing. And then there's this, and the Ten Commandments that we think of, but actually like when the law stuff came in, apparently is a much later addition to the Bible. And he cites how it's really similar to the Code of Hammurabi that the Babylonians did. And actually like talks about how, like, then draws this connection about how the Jews, like traditional sort of thing is that like the Babylonians were these like really bad people that, you know, were enemies of God and enemies of the Jews or something. But it turns out that the Jews were probably like really close to the Babylonians for a pretty long period of time and heavily influenced by them. And that's when like the law stuff came in, like post Hammurabi. And that some of the, like, the eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth thing is almost certainly directly lifted from the Code of Hammurabi, where he says, like, yeah, kind of that same phrase. But anyway, so then he's just like, so if all of this is true and we can control our own brains, then why are we letting this stuff control our brain? And can we go back to the original part of the Bible before it had been? And it kind of goes exactly back to the Graeber thing, is that the way the Bible is now is not inevitable. And yeah, that it had an evolution, and that there's a part of the Bible that points to this like Eden kind of place that existed before there was authoritarianism, that there's a core to that document that points back to a time when there wasn't a coercive state and where there weren't restrictive laws and things like that. And it's kind of almost ends as this almost call to action to try and revert back to that state. It's an amazing book. It's really, really, it's really dense and really good. And I did not do it justice at all, but that's the second book in his trilogy. The first book was, there was only one copy left that I couldn't buy because it was like, I didn't want to buy because it was trashed. And he's mailing me one sometime soon. I can't wait to read it because it's just fascinating.
Wow. Well, cool. Yeah, I don't know anything about the Bible, so nothing.
What do you? All
this talk about the Garden of Eden is making me hungry.
Don't eat the apple.
I ate an apple earlier. Yeah, I ate an apple right before we got on the phone. Yeah, I just don't know anything about it. It just seems so fictitious and irrelevant to me. Just don't get it. But it's not irrelevant, obviously. I mean, there's so many things based on it throughout history, but I just don't get it.
Well, there are parts of it that I like reading because it's good literature, even in translation. And the stories are so resonant. Oh, Job was the guy that he tortured. Patience of Job was the guy that the mean God Almighty tortured. And just like, they're like, Satan and him were like sitting in a bar one day, and Satan's like, whoa, you know, that Job dude, he seems to like you a lot, you know? I'll bet you of like, you know, 45 shekels or whatever that he'll turn to me if you torture him long enough. And God's like, you're on. And I start torturing him, like doing horrible things to him, making him burn and killing all his kids, like destroying his village and like all this stuff. And like, and Job is like, why are you doing this to me, God? I know there must be a purpose. And God's like, yeah, I made this bet. but I don't know.
Is that the lesson of blind faith?
There's great stories, and there's I don't know. I like the allegories. Like I think there's hidden meaning in this stuff. But you're less inclined in that direction than I am, and you're much more practical and positive. Yeah, you know, nice. Like in a spiritual sense, not like. Not in the way, like when people say materialist nowadays, they mean like you're into cars and stuff like that, you know, or, you know, Louis Vuitton, you know, toilet seats or something. Then that's not what I mean when I say materialist. I think of it in the like spiritual sense or philosophical. Or like
the physical world.
Yeah, if you can't prove it. And I tend that way too, but I've always been fascinated by the intangible and kind of, you know, have lived a lot by intuition and have found it, you know, I mean, to be more interesting than a coin toss, if not more effective, to go back to Jack Lord. And actually, yeah. I mean, that's perfect because we were just talking about the Lord of Hosts.
Yeah.
The Jack Lord of Hosts. And I think we just came up with a title.
Yes. That's awesome. Well, cool. We should probably wrap it up. But, been a great conversation.
No doubt. We have to do more. This was a good one, I think. We gotta talk more. Lots of places. There's still lots of places to go. Well, thanks everybody for listening. We hope you enjoyed this show, and there'll be another one happening soon.
Thanks to Jason Bro, our producer, and tell a friend.